balancing Newton's laws of gravity and motion and Einstein's theory of special relativity, when these ideas were considered radical. During the half-century after Copernicus published his model of the Earth revolving around the Sun, later-born scientists were 5.4 times more likely to endorse the Copernican model than firstborns. After Galileo invented the telescope and published his discoveries supporting the model, the ratio dropped to 1:1. Since the theory was no longer radical, firstborns accepted it at equal rates. The most telling evidence that later children may be born to rebel comes from Sulloway's analysis of reactions to the theory of evolution. He assessed how hundreds of scientists responded to the notion of evolution from 1700 to 1859, before Darwin released his famous findings. Prior to Darwin, 56 of 117 later-borns believed in evolution, compared with only 9 of 103 firstborns. In the 16 years after Darwin published his discoveries, the later-born odds of supporting evolution dropped from 9.7 times to 4.6 times greater than firstborns. As the ideas gained scientific acceptance, firstborns were more comfortable advocating for them. We assume that younger scientists will be more receptive to rebellious ideas than older scientists, who become conservative and entrenched in their beliefs with age. But remarkably, birth order was more consequential than age. An 80-year-old later-born was as open to evolutionary theory as a 25-year-old firstborn, Sulloway writes, arguing that evolutionary theory only became a historical reality because later-borns outnumbered firstborns 2.6:1 in the general population. Overall, later-borns were twice as likely as firstborns to champion major scientific upheavals. The likelihood of this difference arising by chance is substantially less than 1 in a billion, Sulloway observes. Later-borns have typically been half a century ahead of firstborns in their willingness to endorse radical innovations. Similar results emerged when he studied 31 political revolutions. Later-borns were twice as likely as firstborns to support radical changes. As a card-carrying firstborn, I was initially dismayed by these results. But as I learned about birth order research, I realized that none of these patterns are set in stone. We don't need to cede originality to later-born children. By adopting the parenting practices that are typically applied primarily to younger children, we can raise any child to become more original. This chapter examines the family roots of originality. What's unique about being a younger child? How does family size figure in? And what are the implications for nurture? And how can we account for the cases that don't fit these patterns? The 3 only children on the base-stealing list, the firstborns who rebel, and the later-born who conform. I'll use birth order as a launching pad for examining the impact of siblings, parents, and role models on our tendencies to take risks. To see why siblings aren't as alike as we expect them to be, I'll look at the upbringing of Jackie Robinson and the families of the most original comedians in America. You'll find out what determines whether children rebel in a constructive or destructive direction, why it's a mistake to tell children not to cheat, how we praise them ineffectively and read them the wrong books, and what we can learn from the parents of individuals who risked their lives to rescue Jews during the Holocaust. Born to Rebel. In 1944, more than a decade before Rosa Parks made her heroic stand on a Montgomery bus, Jackie Robinson, then an Army lieutenant, was court-martialed for refusing to sit at the back of a bus. The driver shouted that if I didn't move to the rear of the bus, he would cause me plenty of trouble, Robinson recounted. I told him hotly that I couldn't care less about his causing me trouble. He gave a similar account for his mad dash toward home plate in the World Series opener. I suddenly decided to shake things up, Robinson explained. It was not the best baseball strategy to steal home with our team 2 runs behind, but I just took off and did it. I really didn't care whether I made it or not. I couldn't care less, and I really didn't care, reveals something fundamental about how Jackie Robinson learned to approach risk. According to eminent Stanford professor James March, when many of us make decisions, we follow a logic of consequence. Which course of action will produce the best result? If you're like Robinson, and you consistently challenge the status quo, you operate differently, using instead a logic of appropriateness. What does a person like me do in a situation like this? Rather than looking outward in an attempt to predict the outcome, you turn inward to your identity. You base the decision on who you are, or who you want to be. When we use the logic of consequence, we can always find reasons not to take risks. The logic of appropriateness frees us up. We think less about what will guarantee the outcome we want and act more on a visceral sense of what someone like us ought to do. And this tendency can be influenced by birth order. For years, experts have touted the advantages of being firstborn. The eldest child in the family is typically set up for success, benefiting from the undivided attention, time, and energy of fawning parents. Evidence shows that firstborns are more likely to win the Nobel Prize in science, become U.S. congressmen, and win local and national elections in the Netherlands. It also appears that they're most likely to rise to the top of corporations. One analysis of more than 1,500 CEOs revealed that 43% were firstborn. In a recent study, economists Marco Bertoni and Giorgio Brunello decided to take a closer look at the impact of birth order on career success. Tracking more than 4,000 people over multiple decades in nearly a dozen European countries, they found that when entering the labor market, firstborns enjoy 14% higher starting salaries than laterborns. Firstborns benefit from greater education, which enables them to command these higher wages. Yet this initial career advantage vanishes by age 30. Laterborns have faster salary growth because they're willing to switch to better-paying jobs sooner and more often. Firstborns are more risk-averse than laterborns, the economists write, noting that the laterborns were also more prone to bad drinking and smoking habits, and were less likely to buy retirement accounts and life insurance packages. Psychologist Dean Simonton explains, "It is not inferior ability that inclines laterborns to perform poorly on standardized tests, to achieve less in school, and to disfavor prestigious occupations. Rather, laterborns may find these firstborn preoccupations to represent distasteful quests for authority and conformity." Although it is beginning to gain some legitimacy, the science of birth order has a checkered past and remains controversial today. Birth order doesn't determine who you are. It only affects the probability that you'll develop in a particular way. There are many other contributing factors, both in your biology and your life experience. To isolate the impact of birth order, the research is inherently messy. You can't conduct randomized controlled experiments. Many studies stop at comparing siblings in different families, when the more rigorous comparison would be within families. And there's little consensus about how to handle subjects like half-siblings, step-siblings, adopted siblings, deceased siblings, and cousins who share a household. Birth order experts continue to fundamentally disagree on many of the conclusions. As a social scientist, I felt it was my responsibility to review the evidence and share my observations about what seems most likely to be true. When I examined the data, birth order was a better predictor of personality and behavior than I had expected. In one study, people ranked their siblings and themselves on school achievement and rebellion. High academic achievers were 2.3 times as likely to be firstborn as lastborn. Rebels were twice as likely to be lastborn as firstborn. and when asked to write about the few most rebellious or unconventional things they had ever done in their lives, laterborns had longer responses and described more unconventional behaviors. Hundreds of studies point to the same conclusion. Although firstborns tend to be more dominant, conscientious, and ambitious, laterborns are more open to taking risks and embracing original ideas. Firstborns tend to defend the status quo. Laterborns are inclined to challenge it. Footnote: there will always be counterexamples. My focus is on the average differences between firstborn and laterborn children and families. Middle children are less studied, because defining who counts as a middle child is more contested than identifying the firstborn or lastborn. Soloway argues that, on average, middle children are the most inclined toward diplomacy. Facing a dominant firstborn, and prevented from dominating the youngest siblings by their parents and older siblings, they master the art of negotiation, persuasion, and coalition building. The irony of relegating middle children to a footnote is not lost on me. There are two dominant explanations for the later-born tendency to take risks. One concerns how children themselves handle sibling rivalry. The other, how parents raise younger children differently. Although we can't control birth order, we can influence how it plays out. Niche picking. Competing by not competing. Look at lots of siblings and you'll notice a baffling fact. The big differences in personality don't exist between families, but within them. When identical twins grow up in the same family, they're no more similar to each other than identical twins who are separated at birth and raised by different families. The same is true of non-twin siblings. They are no more similar when reared together than when reared apart, Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker summarizes. And adopted siblings are no more similar than two people plucked off the street at random. This holds for originality. In adulthood, adopted siblings don't resemble each other at all in tendencies toward nonconformity or risk-taking, despite having been raised by the same parents. Niche-picking might help to make sense of this mystery. This concept has its roots in the work of the physician and psychotherapist Alfred Adler, who came to believe that Sigmund Freud's emphasis on parenting failed to account for the critical influence of siblings on personality development. Adler argued that because firstborn children start life as only children, they initially identify with their parents. When a younger sibling arrives, firstborns risk being dethroned and often respond by emulating their parents. They enforce rules and assert their authority over the younger sibling, which sets the stage for the younger child to rebel. Faced with the intellectual and physical challenges of competing directly with an older sibling, the younger chooses a different way to stand out. The niche of the responsible achiever is particularly likely to be open for an eldest child, Soloway writes. Once this niche is taken, it is difficult for a younger sibling to compete effectively for the same niche. In one early study, psychologist Helen Koch asked teachers to rate more than 300 children from two-child families, matched on birth order, sex, sibling sex, age, and social class. The firstborns scored significantly higher in assertiveness and dominance, regardless of whether they were male or female. As psychologist Frank Dumont notes, firstborn girls were actually more masculine on average than their second-born brothers. They tend to behave like alpha males. This depends, of course, on the age distance between siblings. If two children are only a year apart, the younger sibling may be smart enough or strong enough to hold her own. If they're 7 years apart in age, the niche is open again for the younger sibling to participate without having to compete directly. In baseball, brothers who were 2 to 5 years apart in age were significantly more likely to play different positions than brothers who were less than 2 years apart or more than 5 years apart. Jackie Robinson ran track in college, but couldn't beat his older brother, Mac, who was 5 years his senior and won an Olympic silver medal in the 200-meter dash. Robinson ended up differentiating himself by winning the NCAA broad jump championship and lettering at UCLA in basketball and football, along with track and baseball. Curious about whether niche picking could be observed in other families, I turned to the world of comedy. At its core, comedy is an act of rebellion. Evidence shows that compared to the norms in the population, comedians tend to be more original and rebellious, and the higher they score on these dimensions, the more professional success they attain. After all, people laugh when a joke deviates from expectations or violates a sacred principle in a harmless way, making the unacceptable acceptable. To challenge expectations and question core values, comedians must take calculated risks. To do it without offending the audience to the point that they tune out, comedians need creativity. The very choice to become a comedian means abandoning the prospect of a stable, predictable career. Jim Carrey's father considered comedy, but chose accounting because it was a safer bet. As Jerry Seinfeld quipped, "I never had a job." Based on what we know about niche picking, I suspected that later-born children would be more likely to become great comedians. More conventional careers would already have been taken by older siblings. So instead of struggling to be smarter or stronger than them, the younger children could be funnier. Unlike other talents, the ability to make people laugh isn't dependent on age or maturity. The bigger your family is, the fewer options you have to distinguish yourself, and the more likely you'll be to choose humor as your niche. Are great comedians more likely to be born last than first? To find out, I analyzed Comedy Central's 2004 list of the 100 greatest stand-up comics of all time. That tally is a who's who of original comedians known for rebellious material that challenges social norms and political ideologies, and includes figures ranging from George Carlin and Chris Rock to Joan Rivers and Jon Stewart. Statistically, there should be an equal number of firstborns and lastborns. When I tracked the birth order of these 100 original comedians, though, 44 of them were the lastborn, compared with only 20 firstborn. They came from families with an average of 3.5 children, yet nearly half of them were the baby of their families. On average, they were born 48% later in the sibling order than they should have been by chance. Comedians with siblings were 83% more likely to be born last than chance would predict. The odds of that many great comedians being last born by chance are 2 in a million. When I turned to specific last-born comedians, I found that their older siblings usually filled more conventional achievement niches. Stephen Colbert is the youngest of 11. His older siblings include an intellectual property attorney, a congressional candidate, and a government lawyer. Chelsea Handler's 5 older siblings are a mechanical engineer, a chef, an accountant, a lawyer, and a nurse. All careers where it's possible to obtain education certifications and stable salaries. Louis C.K.'s 3 older sisters are a doctor, a teacher, and a software engineer. All 5 of Jim Gaffigan's older siblings are managers, 3 bank executives, a department store GM, and an operations manager. Mel Brooks's 3 older brothers were a chemist, a bookstore owner, and a government official. Niche picking helps to solve the mystery of why siblings aren't terribly similar. Later-born children actively seek to be different. But there's more to this story than children's attempting to stand out. As hard as they may try to be consistent, parents treat children differently based on birth order, which wedges their personalities even further apart. Birth order effects aren't purely environmental. There's reason to believe that biological factors can contribute as well. Evidence suggests that the more older brothers a man has, the more likely he is to be homosexual. Each older brother increases the probability that a man is homosexual by about 33%, possibly by causing maternal immune systems to produce more antibodies to testosterone, which influence the developing fetus. This birth order effect holds only for men and is unique to the number of older brothers, not younger brothers or older or younger sisters. Researchers estimate that at least 1 in 7 gay men can attribute their homosexuality to the effects of older brothers. And among gay men with at least 3 older brothers, the birth order effect is stronger than all other causes. The slippery slope of strict parenting. Psychologist Robert Zients observed that firstborns grow up in a world of adults, while the more older siblings you have, the more time you spend learning from other children. Had Jackie Robinson been the first child, he would have been raised primarily by his mother. But with 5 children to feed, Mally Robinson needed to work. As a result, Robinson's older sister, Willa May, reflected, "I was the little mother." She bathed him, dressed him, and fed him. When she went to kindergarten, she convinced her mother to let her bring her baby brother to school with her. A 3-year-old Jackie Robinson played in the sandbox all day for a year, with Willa May poking her head out the window periodically to make sure he was okay. Meanwhile, Robinson's older brother Frank was ready to defend him in fights. When older siblings serve as surrogate parents and role models, you don't face as many rules or punishments, and you enjoy the security of their protection. You also end up taking risks earlier. Instead of emulating the measured, carefully considered choices of adults, you follow the lead of other children. Even when the parenting role isn't delegated to children, parents tend to start out as strict disciplinarians with firstborns and become increasingly flexible with laterborns. Parents often relax as they gain experience, and there simply aren't as many chores for the last-born children to do, because their older siblings handle them. When Robinson joined a neighborhood gang, he got caught stealing and shoplifting on a regular basis. On more than one occasion, instead of enforcing punishment, Robinson's mother marched to the police station and told the captain he was being too harsh on her son. He could get away with these antics, writes biographer Mary Kay Ling, because he had always been coddled. After all, Jackie was the baby of the family, and he never had the same responsibilities that his siblings had. The parental response to the youngest child can tilt in a darker direction. The poster victim of this path is Andre Agassi, the first man ever to win all 4 Grand Slams and an Olympic gold medal in singles tennis. His father dreamed of raising a tennis champion, and when the first 3 children fell short, the pressure was focused on the lastborn, Andre. His father was abusive, forcing him to practice for hours on end, dictating his schedule, and forbidding him from playing other sports. Andre grew up with a crushing awareness of being the last best hope of the Agassi clan. Andre rebelled by flouting many of the game's unwritten rules. He donned a mohawk, a mullet, and earrings, played in denim shorts and pink pants instead of traditional whites, and dated singer Barbara Streisand, 28 years his senior. "Having no choice, having no say about what I do or who I am, makes me crazy," Agassi reflected. "Rebellion is the one thing I get to choose every day. Bucking authority, sending a message to my father, thrashing against the lack of choice in my life." His story suggests that there are 2 opposing ways for parents to raise rebels: giving children the autonomy and protection to get away with it, or restricting their freedom to the point that they fight back. We can see this shift in parenting patterns in the experience of Liz Winstead, who co-created The Daily Show. It was the first news program to use comedy to challenge the established media's presentation of current events, looking like the news but parodying it at the same time. "We are going to make fun of them by becoming them," Winstead writes. "It simply had never been done before." Growing up in Minnesota as the youngest of 5 children of extremely conservative parents, Winstead was given far more freedom than her siblings. "I walked all over my parents because they were old. I had a lot of leeway. I stopped asking for permission to do things. I took public buses alone. I stayed out all night. They went on vacations and left me alone in high school. They were just more exhausted. They forgot to say, "You can't do that." When she was a child, despite the fact that she didn't know how to swim, her mother didn't warn her what would happen if she fell out of an inner tube in the middle of a lake. "I didn't know I was supposed to be scared, and in a nutshell, that is why I dove into everything head first," Winstead explains. "Then, as now, I looked at life's challenges as dares rather than uphill battles, and consequently the results of this glaring parental oversight led to a lifetime of me torturing them with my chronic pluckiness." From her earliest days, Winstead had to stand out to get noticed. As her brother Jean, now a mayor, recalls, "The whole family would pipe up all the time, so she, being the runt, would have to pipe up that much louder." At 10, Winstead questioned her Catholic teacher on why dogs and Jews don't go to heaven. At 12, when a priest told her she couldn't be an altar boy, she challenged him by proposing to become an altar girl, and wrote a letter championing the idea to the bishop, a notion her parents didn't discourage. Even when they did object to her values, her parents continued to support her. Years later, when she spoke out in favor of abortion, she overheard her father say, "At least my daughter says what she thinks and doesn't hide who she is." The larger the family, the more later-borns face lax rules and get away with things that their elder siblings wouldn't have. "I'm from a very large family, 9 parents," comedian Jim Gaffigan jokes. When you're the youngest of a big family, by the time you're a teenager, your parents are insane. While we can explain the risk-taking of many originals by virtue of the unusual autonomy and protection that they received as the babies of their families, these parenting behaviors can nurture rebellion among children at any position in the birth order. They may just be most common with the youngest child. Interestingly, Soloway finds that predicting personality is more challenging with only children than with children who have siblings. Like firstborns, only children grow up in a world of adults and identify with parents. Like lastborns, they are protected fiercely, which leaves them freer to become radicals themselves. The evidence on birth order highlights the importance of giving children freedom to be original. But one of the dangers of doing so is that they might use that freedom to rebel in ways that put themselves or others at risk. Once a child of any birth order is motivated to be original, what determines the direction in which she will channel that originality? I wanted to learn why Jackie Robinson abandoned gang life and became a civil rights activist, and what factors shape whether children use their freedom to become honorable or antisocial, proactive or passive, creative or destructive. Answering this question has been the life's work of Samuel and Pearl Oliner, a sociologist and an education researcher. They conducted a pioneering study of non-Jews who risked their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust, comparing these heroic individuals with a group of neighbors who lived in the same towns but did not extend help to Jews. The rescuers had much in common with the bystanders: similar educational backgrounds, occupations, homes, neighborhoods, and political and religious beliefs. They were also equally rebellious in their childhoods. The rescuers were just as likely as the bystanders to be disciplined by their parents for disobeying, stealing, lying, cheating, aggressing, and failing to do what they were told. What differentiated the rescuers was how their parents disciplined bad behavior and praised good behavior. Great explanations. Years ago, researchers found that from ages 2 to 10, children are urged by their parents to change their behavior once every 6 to 9 minutes. As developmental psychologist Martin Hoffman sums it up, this translates roughly into 50 discipline encounters a day, or over 15,000 a year. When the Holocaust rescuers recalled their childhoods, they had received a unique form of discipline from their parents. "Explained" is the word most rescuers favored, the Oliners discovered. It is in their reliance on reasoning, explanations, suggestions of ways to remedy the harm done, persuasion, and advice that the parents of rescuers differed most. Reasoning communicates a message of respect. It implies that had children but known better or understood more, they would not have acted in an inappropriate way. It is a mark of esteem for the listener, an indication of faith in his or her ability to comprehend, develop, and improve. While reasoning accounted for only 6% of the disciplinary techniques that the bystanders' parents used, it accounted for a full 21% of how the rescuers' parents disciplined their children. One rescuer said her mother told me when I did something wrong. She never did any punishing or scolding. She tried to make me understand with my mind what I'd done wrong. This rational approach to discipline also characterizes the parents of teenagers who don't engage in criminal deviance and originals who challenge the orthodoxies of their professions. In one study, parents of ordinary children had an average of 6 rules, like specific schedules for homework and bedtime. Parents of highly creative children had an average of less than 1 rule and tended to place emphasis on moral values rather than on specific rules, psychologist Teresa Amabile reports. If parents do believe in enforcing a lot of regulations, the way they explain them matters a great deal. New research shows that teenagers defy rules when they're enforced in a controlling manner, by yelling or threatening punishment. When mothers enforce many rules but offer a clear rationale for why they're important, teenagers are substantially less likely to break them because they internalize them. In Donald McKinnon's study comparing America's most creative architects with a group of highly skilled but unoriginal peers, a factor that distinguished the creative group was that their parents exercised discipline with explanations. They outlined their standards of conduct and explained their grounding in a set of principles about right and wrong, referencing values like morality, integrity, respect, curiosity, and perseverance. But emphasis was placed upon the development of one's ethical code, McKinnon wrote. Above all, the parents who raised highly creative architects granted their children the autonomy to choose their own values. Reasoning does create a paradox. It leads to both more rule following and more rebelliousness. By explaining moral principles, parents encourage their children to comply voluntarily with rules that align with important values and to question rules that don't. Good explanations enable children to develop a code of ethics that often coincides with societal expectations. When they don't square up, children rely on the internal compass of values rather than the external compass of rules. There's a particular kind of explanation that works especially well in enforcing discipline. When the Olliners examined the guidance of the Holocaust rescuers' parents, they found that they tended to give explanations of why behaviors are inappropriate, often with reference to their consequences for others. While the bystanders' parents focused on enforcing compliance with rules for their own sake, the rescuers' parents encouraged their children to consider the impact of their actions on others. According to Martin Hoffman, explaining the impact of behavior on others should take shape differently depending on the child's age. When children are very young, parents can start by explaining how their behavior causes visible harm to a victim. If you push him again, he'll fall down and cry. Or, if you throw snow on their walk, they will have to clean it up all over again. As children mature, parents can begin to explain the impact on basic feelings. You really hurt Mary and made her feel sad when you took her doll. Or, he feels bad when you don't share your toys with him, just like you would feel bad if he didn't share with you. Later, parents can direct attention to more subtle feelings. She's upset because she was proud of her tower and you knocked it down. Or, try to be quiet so he can sleep longer and feel better when he wakes up. Highlighting consequences for others directs attention to the distress of the person who may be harmed by an individual's behavior, fueling empathy for her. It also helps children understand the role that their own actions played in causing the harm, resulting in guilt. As Irma Bombeck put it, guilt is the gift that keeps on giving. The dual moral emotions of empathy and guilt activate the desire to right wrongs of the past and behave better in the future. Emphasizing consequences for others can motivate adults, too. In hospitals, to encourage doctors and nurses to wash their hands more often, my colleague David Hoffman and I posted two different signs near soap and gel dispensers. Hand hygiene prevents you from catching diseases. Hand hygiene prevents patients from catching diseases. Over the next 2 weeks, a member of each hospital unit covertly counted the number of times that medical professionals washed their hands before and after each patient contact, while an independent team measured the amount of soap and gel used from each dispenser. The first sign had no effect whatsoever. The second sign made a significant difference. Merely mentioning patients instead of you led medical professionals to wash their hands 10% more often and use 45% more soap and gel. Thinking about oneself invokes the logic of consequence. Will I get sick? Doctors and nurses can answer swiftly with a no. I spend a lot of time in a hospital, I don't always wash, and I rarely get sick, so this probably won't affect me. In general, we tend to be overconfident about our own invulnerability to harm. But thinking about patients prompts a logic of appropriateness. What should a person like me do in a situation like this? It changes the calculation from a cost-benefit equation to a contemplation of values, of right and wrong. I have a professional and moral obligation to care for patients. An explanation of how his behavior affected others represented the first major turning point in Jackie Robinson's life. As a leader in the neighborhood gang, Robinson was hurling dirt at cars and rocks through windows, stealing golf balls and selling them back to players, and pilfering food and supplies from local stores. After one offense, the sheriff took him to jail at gunpoint. Seeing the gang in action, a mechanic named Carl Anderson took Robinson aside. "He made me see that if I continued with the gang, it would hurt my mother," Robinson wrote. He said it didn't take guts to follow the crowd, that courage and intelligence lay in being willing to be different. "I was too ashamed to tell Carl how right he was, but what he said got to me." Once he considered how his behavior would affect his mother, Robinson didn't want to let her down, and he left the gang. After I finished writing this section, our daughters were running around the family room, putting our crawling toddler son in jeopardy. I told them to stop running 7 times, and it had no effect. Realizing I was failing to follow my own advice about explaining the impact on others, I changed my strategy. Turning to our 6-year-old, I posed a question, "Why am I asking you not to run?" With a concerned look, she immediately responded, "Because we could hurt our brother." I asked, "Do you want to hurt him?" She shook her head, and our 4-year-old piped up, "No!" I announced a new rule: no running in the family room, because we don't want to hurt anyone. I put the girls in charge of enforcing the rule, and they stopped running immediately. Their good behavior stuck. They spent the rest of the afternoon monitoring each other's non-running. But a few days later, they started running again. Only then did I learn that explanations of our impact on others are most likely to have a lasting effect if they're coupled with a statement of principles. "She's crying because she wants to play with your toys" doesn't do much good alone. The more meaningful statement is, "She's crying because she wants to play with your toys, and in this family, we always share." Persona non grata, or why nouns are better than verbs. Assuming that parents decide to give children the freedom to be original, what does it take to foster a sense of right and wrong? Values aren't formed only by how parents react when children misstep. In the study of Holocaust rescuers and bystanders, when the Olliners asked about the values they learned from their parents, the rescuers were 3 times more likely than the bystanders to reference moral values that apply to all people. The rescuers emphasized that their parents taught me to respect all human beings. While bystanders also held moral values, they attached them to specific behaviors and in-group members. Pay attention in school. Don't get in fights with your peers. Be polite to your neighbors. Be honest with your friends and loyal to your families. Moral standards are forged in part by what parents say after children do the right thing. The last time you saw a child engage in good behavior, how did you respond? My guess is that you praised the action, not the child. That was really nice. That was so sweet. By complimenting the behavior, you reinforce it, so the child will learn to repeat it. Not so fast, says an experiment led by psychologist Joan Grusek. After children shared some marbles with their peers, a number of them were randomly assigned to have their behavior praised. It was good that you gave some of your marbles to those poor children. Yes, that was a nice and helpful thing to do. Others received character praise. I guess you're the kind of person who likes to help others whenever you can. Yes, you are a very nice and helpful person. Children who received character praise were subsequently more generous. Of the children who were complimented for being helpful people, 45% gave craft materials to cheer up kids at a hospital 2 weeks later, compared with only 10% of the children who were commended for engaging in helpful behavior. When our character is praised, we internalize it as part of our identities. Instead of seeing ourselves as engaging in isolated moral acts, we start to develop a more unified self-concept as a moral person. Affirming character appears to have the strongest effect in the critical periods when children are beginning to formulate strong identities. In one study, for example, praising character boosted the moral actions of 8-year-olds, but not 5-year-olds or 10-year-olds. The 10-year-olds may already have crystallized self-concepts to the degree that a single comment didn't affect them, and the 5-year-olds may have been too young for an isolated compliment to have a real impact. Character praise leaves a lasting imprint when identities are forming. There's an interesting tension between this research on the benefits of praising character and a famous body of research on the value of praising effort. In Mindset, the Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck describes her groundbreaking studies demonstrating that when we praise children for their intelligence, they develop a fixed view of ability, which leads them to give up in the face of failure. Instead of telling them how smart they are, it's wise to praise their effort, which encourages them to see their abilities as malleable and persist to overcome obstacles. How can we reconcile these competing ideas about praising the person in the moral domain, but the behavior in the skill domain? Praising character can lead children to think, "I'm a good person, so I can do a bad thing," or more frighteningly, "I'm a good person, so how could this be a bad thing?" This is why it's so important to exercise discipline as described earlier. It motivates children to develop clear moral standards and emotions that discourage bad behaviors. My bet is that character praise coupled with discipline leads to the most moral choices. But even among very young children, an appeal to character can have an influence in the moment. In an ingenious series of experiments led by psychologist Christopher Bryan, children between ages 3 and 6 were 22% to 29% more likely to clean up blocks, toys, and crayons when they were asked to be helpers instead of to help. Even though their character was far from gelled, they wanted to earn the identity. Bryan finds that appeals to character are effective for adults as well. His team was able to cut cheating in half with the same turn of phrase. Instead of, "Please don't cheat," they changed the appeal to, "Please don't be a cheater." When you're urged not to cheat, you can do it and still see an ethical person in the mirror. But when you're told not to be a cheater, the act casts a shadow. Immorality is tied to your identity, making the behavior much less attractive. Cheating is an isolated action that gets evaluated with the logic of consequence. Can I get away with it? Being a cheater evokes a sense of self, triggering the logic of appropriateness. What kind of person am I, and who do I want to be? In light of this evidence, Brian suggests that we should embrace nouns more thoughtfully. Don't drink and drive could be rephrased as don't be a drunk driver. The same thinking can be applied to originality. When a child draws a picture, instead of calling the artwork creative, we can say, you are creative. After a teenager resists the temptation to follow the crowd, we can commend her for being a nonconformist. When we shift our emphasis from behavior to character, people evaluate choices differently. Instead of asking whether this behavior will achieve the results they want, they take action because it is the right thing to do. In the poignant words of one Holocaust rescuer, it's like saving somebody who is drowning. You don't ask them what God they pray to. You just go and save them. Why parents aren't the best role models. We can afford to give children a great deal of freedom if we explain the consequences of their actions on others and emphasize how the right moral choices demonstrate good character. This increases the odds that they will develop the instinct to express their original impulses in the form of moral or creative actions, as opposed to deviant ones. But as they grow up, they often don't aim high enough. When psychologists Penelope Lockwood and Ziva Kunda asked college students to list what they hoped to achieve over the following decade, they came up with perfectly ordinary objectives. Another group of students was instructed to read a newspaper article about an outstanding peer and then list their goals. They aimed much higher. Having a role model elevated their aspirations. Role models have a foundational impact on how children grow up to express their originality. When hundreds of women who graduated from Radcliffe College were asked in their early 30s to name the people who had the greatest influence on their lives, the vast majority mentioned parents and mentors. 17 years later, psychologists Bill Peterson and Abigail Stewart measured the women's commitments to changing things for the better for future generations. Naming a parent as a major influence accounted for less than 1% of the women's motivations to drive meaningful change. The women who were pursuing originality had been influenced a decade and a half earlier, not by their parents, but by their mentors. Mentioning a mentor accounted for 14% of differences in women's desires to improve the world. The paradox of encouraging children to develop strong values is that parents effectively limit their own influence. Parents can nurture the impulse to be original, but at some point, people need to find their own role models for originality in their chosen fields. In comedy, Liz Winstead drew inspiration from comedian Roseanne Barr, both for her talents on stage and her support of women off it. When Winstead went public with her rebellious political views, her father quipped, "I screwed up. I raised you to have an opinion, and I forgot to tell you it was supposed to be mine." If we want to encourage originality, the best step we can take is to raise our children's aspirations by introducing them to different kinds of role models. "I might have become a full-fledged juvenile delinquent," Jackie Robinson acknowledged, "if it had not been for the influence of two men." One was the mechanic who explained how his gang behavior was hurting his mother. The other was a young minister, Carl Downs. Noticing that adolescents were being forced by their parents to attend church and many were dropping out, Downs instituted some unconventional changes, holding dances at the church, and building a badminton court. Many of the members protested, clinging to the traditions of the past, but Downs persisted. Inspired by a man who was willing to challenge orthodoxy in order to engage children, Robinson volunteered to become a Sunday school teacher and became determined to open doors for others, as Downs had done for him. In baseball, Robinson found another original mentor in Branch Rickey, the Dodgers owner who recruited him to break the color barrier. Robinson was already 26 when Rickey summoned him to his office. Rickey had been scouting black players who could run, throw, and hit, and once he had a group of candidates with similarly extraordinary ability, he started evaluating their character, inviting them to meet in the guise of starting a new Negro League. Once he chose Robinson, Rickey encouraged him to take some risks on the base path, run wild to steal the pants off them, but urged him to be more cautious outside the lines. "I want a ball player with guts enough not to fight back." Finding the right mentor is not always easy, but we can locate role models in a more accessible place, the stories of great originals throughout history. Human rights advocate Malala Yousafzai was moved by reading biographies of Mina, an activist for equality in Afghanistan, and of Martin Luther King Jr. King was inspired by Gandhi, as was Nelson Mandela. In some cases, fictional characters may be even better role models. Growing up, many originals find their first heroes in their most beloved novels, where protagonists exercise their creativity in pursuit of unique accomplishments. When asked to name their favorite books, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel each chose Lord of the Rings, the epic tale of a hobbit's adventures to destroy a dangerous ring of power. Sheryl Sandberg and Jeff Bezos both pointed to A Wrinkle in Time, in which a young girl learns to bend the laws of physics and travel through time. Mark Zuckerberg was partial to Ender's Game, where it's up to a group of kids to save the planet from an alien attack. Jack Ma named his favorite childhood book as Alibaba and the 40 Thieves, about a woodcutter who takes the initiative to change his own fate. It's likely that they were all highly original children, which accounts for why they were drawn to these tales in the first place. But it's also possible that these stories helped elevate their aspirations. Remarkably, there are studies showing that when children's stories emphasize original achievements, the next generation innovates more. In one study, psychologists tracked unique accomplishments in American children's stories from 1800 to 1950. After original achievement themes in American children's books rose by 66% from 1810 to 1850, the patent rate shot up sevenfold from 1850 to 1890. Children's books reflected the values popular at the time, but also helped to nurture those values. When stories emphasized original achievement, patent rates typically soared 20 to 40 years later. As Dean Simonton summarizes, it took time for the children exposed to the achievement imagery in school to grow up and contribute to the creation of new inventions. Unlike biographies, in fictional stories, characters can perform actions that have never been accomplished before, making the impossible seem possible. The inventors of the modern submarine and helicopter were transfixed by Jules Verne's visions in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Clipper of the Clouds. One of the earliest rockets was built by a scientist who drew his motivation from an H.G. Wells novel. Some of the earliest mobile phones, tablets, GPS navigators, portable digital storage disks, and multimedia players were designed by people who watched Star Trek characters using similar devices. As we encounter these images of originality in history and fiction, the logic of consequence fades away. We no longer worry as much about what will happen if we fail. Undoubtedly, the next generation of originals will draw inspiration from the Harry Potter series, which is brimming with references to original accomplishment. Harry Potter is the only wizard who can defeat Voldemort. With his friends Hermione and Ron, he learns unique spells and invents new ways of defending against the dark arts. We see the children's spirits rise when they succeed, and they are crestfallen when they fail. Along with giving a generation of children role models for originality, J.K. Rowling embedded a moral message in her novels. Recent experiments show that reading Harry Potter can improve children's attitudes toward marginalized groups. As they see Harry and Hermione face discrimination for not having pure wizard blood, they empathize and become less prejudiced toward minority groups in their own lives. When children identify strongly enough with heroes who exemplify originality, it might even change the way that niche picking unfolds. Among siblings, later-borns often become original after their siblings fill conventional niches. But wherever we fall in the birth order, when we have compelling role models for originality, they expand our awareness of niches that we had never considered. Instead of causing us to rebel because traditional avenues are closed, the protagonists in our favorite stories may inspire originality by opening our minds to unconventional paths. Chapter 7. Rethinking Groupthink. The Myths of Strong Cultures, Cults, and Devil's Advocates. In fact, the only sin which we never forgive in each other is difference of opinion. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Standing on stage in front of a captive audience, a technology icon pulled a new device out of his pocket. It was so much smaller than competing products that no one in the room could believe his eyes. The founder's flair for theatrical product launches wasn't the only source of his fame. He was known for his singular creative vision, a passion for blending science and art, an obsession with design and quality, and a deep disdain for market research. "We give people products they do not even know they want," he remarked, after introducing a revolutionary gadget that helped to popularize the selfie. The man urged people to think different. He led his company to greatness and redefined multiple industries, only to be unceremoniously forced out by his own board of directors and then watch the empire he created start to crumble before his eyes. As much as this story seems to describe Steve Jobs, the visionary was actually one of Jobs's heroes, Edwin Land, the founder of Polaroid. Today, Land is best remembered for inventing the instant camera, which gave rise to an entire generation of amateur photographers, and enabled Ansel Adams to take his famous landscape photographs, Andy Warhol to make his celebrity portraits, and NASA astronauts to capture the sun. But Land was responsible for something bigger. The polarizing light filter that's still used in billions of products, from sunglasses and digital watches to pocket calculators and 3D movie glasses. He also played a vital role in conceiving and designing the U-2 spy plane for President Dwight Eisenhower, which changed the course of the Cold War. In total, Land amassed 535 patents, more than any American before him, other than Thomas Edison. In 1985, just a few months before getting kicked out of Apple, Steve Jobs shared his admiration for Land. "One of the great inventors of our time. The man is a national treasure." Land may have been a great original, but he failed to instill those attributes in his company's culture. In an ironic twist, Polaroid was one of the companies that pioneered the digital camera, yet ultimately went bankrupt because of it. As early as 1981, the company was making major strides in electronic imaging. By the end of the decade, Polaroid's digital sensors could capture quadruple the resolution of competitors' products. A high-quality prototype of a digital camera was ready in 1992, but the electronic imaging team could not convince their colleagues to launch it until 1996. Despite earning awards for technical excellence, Polaroid's product floundered, as by then, more than 40 competitors had released their own digital cameras. Polaroid fell due to a faulty assumption. Within the company, there was widespread